to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Some Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with a reading from USA Today Sports Weekly that reads, How are the Arizona Cardinals winning? It starts with physicality. And this feature is written by Theo Mackey of the Arizona Republic. How are the Arizona Cardinals suddenly so good? It's a question flummoxing the NFL. This is a team that is coming off consecutive four-win seasons and that looked mired in mediocrity a month ago. Now they are 6 wins, 4 losses atop the NFC West division and playing like one of the best teams in the league, at least temporarily. The answer starts with a tenet that Jonathan Gannon promised to instill from day one, their physicality. Part of the Cardinals' physicality is schematic. According to Sumer Sports, they use multiple tight ends on 46% of offensive snaps, second only to the Kansas City Chiefs. They also leaned heavily on multiple tight end looks heavily last year in offensive coordinator Drew Petzing's first season. But this offseason, they drafted blocking tight end Tip Raymond in the 3rd round, enabling them to use their tight ends in even more ways. And naturally, those looks are conducive to running the ball. The Cardinals have run 193 plays out of multiple tight end sets this season, the most in the league. They're also averaging 4.8 yards per carry on those plays, the 3rd most in the league. Not just that, but 130 of those plays run have been gap schemes as opposed to the zone running style that has seen a popularity boom over the past decade. No other team has more than 75 such runs. It's a bruising, physical style that is hard on defenses. These runs against the Jets in a 31-6 Week 10 win show 3 different ways in which the Cardinals can use their tight ends. On the first, they align all 3 tight ends to the same side, using them to seal off the front side of the play for Trey Benson. On the second, they use Trey McBride's receiving threat as a decoy out of the backfield, helping freeze a linebacker. And on the third, Elijah Higgins lines up as a fullback as all 3 tight ends work up to the 2nd level. They help spring James Conner up the middle for a 12-yard gain, Conner's longest of the day. Higgins' usage perhaps best exemplifies the Arizona Cardinals' commitment to their power run game. He was a wide receiver in college and is in just his 2nd season as a tight end, but he's had no qualms about his role in an offense that utilizes him more as a blocker than as a pass catcher. The Cardinals' usage of their tight ends also has major advantages in the passing game. Kyler Murray has seen base defense, meaning 4 defensive backs are on the field as opposed to the 5 defensive back looks that are most common in the modern NFL, more than all but 2 other quarterbacks. On those plays, Murray is averaging 10.2 yards per attempt compared with 6.6 yards per attempt against 5 or 6 defensive backs. On all 3 of these plays, the Cardinals line up with multiple tight ends. The Jets know the threat that poses in the running game, so they counter with 3 linebackers, sacrificing a defensive back. On the 1st play, two of the linebackers bite on the run fake, opening a void for Marvin Harrison Jr., who recognizes the zone coverage and slows down his route to stay open. That's the rookie receiver owning a sense for the opposing defense that he didn't always have earlier in the season. "I'm making decisions faster. I'm reading the defense," said Harrison. "That's part of my preparation as well, my film study throughout the week, getting an idea of what the defense likes to do. Allowing myself to go out there and play fast, I think that's something that I have gotten better at each week," unquote. On the second play, there's no run threat after Trey Benson motions out wide. But the motion confuses the Jets' defense, which never quite recovers. Plus, their three-linebacker look creates a mismatch for McBride. Like Harrison, McBride does well to recognize zone coverage and settle down in the empty space. "I have to run my route within a certain restriction, and I kind of have a little area to work with," McBride said. "Based on different coverages, I can do certain things. The game's really slowed down for me the last couple years. I'm able to really see the coverages, understand what's happening before it happens. And Kyler is really good at understanding that as well," unquote. On the third play, the Jets simply sell out for the run. That enables McBride to slip across the field unnoticed and get wide open on the backside of the play. This is what Pedsing envisioned back in training camp. Quote, "We put multiple tight ends on the field. Are you going to stay base? Are you going to be in nickel?" Pedsing said at the time. "Are you going to put five down on the field? And the more you have to worry about that, you now have to defend multiple offenses with those people on the field," unquote. The other aspect of the Cardinals' physicality comes down to mindset. Gannon's favorite catchphrase is motor and violence. He demands that his players display consistent aggression. Recently, they've exemplified that. Quote, "The thing that's consistent with our team is how we play," Gannon said. "The effort, the motor, the finish, the violence, the hitting. I think there's a way to play this game, and that can give you a chance to win a bunch of games if that part is right. And everybody is doing it," unquote. It shows up on both sides of the ball, but it's particularly clear on offense. On all four of these plays, the Cardinals' offensive line shows a high level of aggression, finishing blocks and flattening defenders. On the first and third plays, it's left tackle Paris Johnson Jr. leading the way to open holes for ball carriers. On the second and fourth plays, it's center Hajalti Frohold doing the same. But really, it's a team effort, one that extends to wide receivers and tight ends. On the first play, Raymond and receiver Michael Wilson sprint 40 yards downfield to help Connor if he needs additional blocks. Neither is ultimately involved in the play, but both are executing the details upon which Gannon harps. That is how a four-game winning streak starts. And again, that feature entitled, "How Are the Cardinals Winning?" It starts with physicality, written by Theo Mackle of the Arizona Republic. And in other NFL news, this next feature is entitled A November Statement Win. This feature written by Jarrett Bell, columnist for USA Today. Bills' fearless approach is the ultimate edge against the Chiefs. Dateline Orchard Park, New York. There was no doubt, no hesitation, and certainly no sort of fear as Sean McDermott faced a critical fourth down decision with a little more than 2 minutes remaining in the much-anticipated showdown at Highmark Stadium on Sunday that lived up to the hype. Kick a field goal? McDermott, the savvy Buffalo Bills coach, knew better. Even with a 40-something yard tray that would have extended the lead to 5 points against the undefeated Kansas City Chiefs, a.k.a. the playoff heartbreakers, McDermott would not have felt safe. So he went for it. Then Josh Allen, the stud quarterback, proved how perfect McDermott's decision was for that moment as he dashed to a dramatic 26-yard touchdown run that essentially snapped Kansas City's 15-game winning streak and squashed any thoughts of a perfect season. The Chiefs left town at 9 wins, 1 loss. I think you have to have a mindset where you cannot be afraid in those situations to do what you believe in, McDermott told USA Today Sports after most of his players had cleared from the locker room after the 30-21 victory. Sometimes the result doesn't work out. Early in the game, it didn't work out. We went for it on 4th and 2, and it didn't work out. So I've got to live with it, unquote. McDermott is undoubtedly thrilled to live with the crunch time decision that helped seal a 6th consecutive victory and pulled the Bills, who are now 9 wins, 2 losses, within a half game of the number one seed for the AFC playoff positioning. It was hardly a spur-of-the-moment call. McDermott and his staff discussed how they would handle such a situation during the week of preparation, knowing who was on the other side. They were plenty mindful of Kansas City's ability and history with Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid in crunch time, of pulling out last-minute drives with touchdown drives. After all, in one of Buffalo's 3 playoff setbacks against the Chiefs during the past 4 seasons, Mahomes needed just 13 seconds to mount a field goal drive that forced overtime. And Kansas City won the coin toss, which led to a touchdown drive that won the AFC divisional playoff game. Anyway, that was then. Last Sunday, the Bills pestered Mahomes throughout the game with 2 sacks, 2 interceptions, 7 quarterback hits, and 196 passing yards, but saw him engineer an efficient 70-yard drive in the 4th quarter that cut the margin to 23-21. Mahomes capped that drive by rolling right and slinging a laser-like pass across his body for a 1-yard touchdown throw to Noah Gray. McDermott was not about to let it come down to Mahomes' magic. Betting on Allen, one of the NFL's best dual-threat quarterbacks, was the better option that effectively was a way to play defense against Mahomes. That's why you go for it on 4th and 2 from their own 26. They are way too good to not go for it right there, McDermott said. Every situation is a little different, but I felt confident, unquote. Then the strapping Allen, the NFL's most physical quarterback at 6'5", 237 pounds, put it on his legs and made it work. The play included an option to throw, but Allen quickly dismissed that. After a quick pump fake to his left, he noticed that the Chiefs' defense dropped into zone coverage. That left him a running lane up the middle, and his eyes probably lit up. He was barely touched until he barreled the final few yards into the end zone. just trying to create and keep the play alive, Allen said. There was a crease and just trusted the feet, unquote. Allen, who has now beaten the Chiefs for a fourth consecutive time in a regular season matchup, sounded a bit nonchalant in describing the game's defining play. But it was fitting that when it mattered the most, he delivered. That's how it's supposed to be in some regards. The leader of the pack, the face of the franchise, rose to the moment. Some guys are just made to play ball, Bills receiver Amari Cooper said, and he is one of those guys, unquote. Cooper, who just joined the Bills last month in a trade with the Cleveland Browns, was the first option on the defining play. Given the final outcome, Cooper could not disagree with the sequence. It was crazy, he said. I'm hoping he throws it. I'm kind of anxious, unquote. Then Allen bolted from the pocket. He easily gained the yardage for a first down. Cooper wondered whether the quarterback would slide. Allen clearly wanted more. I wasn't sure that he was going for it, said Cooper, who caught two passes for 55 yards in the game. But he knew the situation. We needed to score. We have this great offense on the other side. I can't slide right there, unquote. No, Allen had no fear. Not with the game on the line. It was the same aggressive approach that McDermott had in making the decision to go for it on fourth down, and not just because a game-tying field goal attempt in the final minutes of the January playoff loss sailed wide right. The no-fear mentality that flowed from McDermott through Allen and other players came with the realization that to beat a champion, Kansas City had won 9 straight games in which it trailed in the second half. You simply cannot play scared when you've got a chance to put them away. After all, the Chiefs are like the never-say-die monster from the horror movie. Yet McDermott and his team did not flinch. The verdict was officially clinched shortly after Allen's touchdown run, when Mahomes was intercepted by Terrell Bernard, squashing any hopes for a last-minute miracle. It's a statement win, Bills edge rusher Von Miller declared. They were undefeated. It's not our Super Bowl. The season is not over. We're not going to the Super Bowl or anything, but we have to celebrate wins like this. It's so hard to win in this league. It's so hard to have success in this league. There's so much that goes into the 60 minutes that we play, so you have to be able to step back, debrief, and look at all the great things that you do, unquote. What are the chances that these teams meet again in the playoffs? 100%, Miller said. In some form or fashion, whether it's at our place, their place, we're going to see the Chiefs again. Whether it's the divisional round, the AFC Championship, or whatever it may be, we're going to see the Chiefs again for sure, unquote. And again, that feature is entitled A November Statement Win. Bill's fearless approach is the ultimate edge against the Chiefs, written by Jarrett Bell, columnist for USA Today. And in one more NFL feature, this one is entitled Bengals Season Might Not Be Salvageable in NFL Week 11 Winners and Losers, written by Lorenzo Reyes of USA Today. Among the winners, it seems unsustainable, but the Steelers are winning without touchdowns. This marks the second time in 2024 that Pittsburgh failed to score a touchdown. yet still managed to win 18-16 over the Ravens. The first time was the season opener, and Sunday, Chris Boswell converted kicks from 32 yards twice, 52 yards, 57 yards, 27 yards, and 50 yards. Boswell has now converted 29 out of 30 field goals this season, proving just how valuable he is. That it came on a day when the normally reliable Justin Tucker missed a pair of field goal attempts underscored that further. Boswell leads the NFL in points scored by 10, and the Steelers, who are now 8 wins, 2 losses, are riding their oppressive defense and pristine special teams to contention for the top seed in the AFC. Yet, at some point, coordinator Arthur Smith's offense will need to be more productive. Also among the winners, the Colts don't compound mistake and course correct with the return of quarterback Anthony Richardson. Even though the Indianapolis Colts may need to manage occasional turnovers for Anthony Richardson, this week showed just how badly Coach Shane Steichen botched the quarterback situation by starting Joe Flacco 2 weeks ago. With Richardson's 2 rushing scores against the New York Jets in a 28-27 win, it became obvious just how much more potent that Indianapolis' rushing attack is when he presents a threat to run. With the Colts down 5 points, Richardson led the Colts on a 6-play, 70-yard game-winning touchdown drive. He completed all 3 of his throws on the drive for 60 yards and ran it twice for 8 yards, including the game-winning score. Most important, the Colts, who are now 5 wins, 6 losses, moved into the number 8 spot in the AFC, 1 spot out of the final wild card slot. Also among the winners, the Dolphins are also finding their form, but is it too late? Now that they are closer to full health, the Miami Dolphins are slowly clawing their way back up the playoff picture, positioning themselves just 1 game back of the Colts. Quarterback Tua Tagovailoa recorded his best game of the season, completing 28 of 36 passes for 288 yards and 3 scores. Tagovailoa still occasionally holds the ball too long and takes unnecessary sacks, but he was notably more decisive against the Las Vegas Raiders. 2 weeks ago, Miami was 2 wins, 6 losses and sitting in the number 12 spot in the AFC. The Dolphins are now 4 wins, 6 losses and now sitting at number 9. The margin for error is slim, but Miami has the 4th easiest remaining strength of schedule, with their opponents having a combined 397 winning percentage. And from the winners in the NFL last week, let's look at the losers some now. This feels like the end for the Bengals season. When Cincinnati scored 21 points in a row to tie the game against Los Angeles, it felt like it was on the verge of saving its season. When the Bengals, who are now 4 wins, 7 losses, allowed the Chargers to march down the field for a game-winning touchdown, it felt like an obituary for their playoff hopes. The Bengals have had a frustrating season in which just about every close game did not go their way. That is not hyperbole. Cincinnati is now 1 win, 6 losses in games decided by 7 points or fewer. In a hypothetical, half of those losses break for the Bengals, since he would then be 7 wins, 4 losses, and in prime position to claim an AFC wildcard berth. Also among the losers are the defending NFC champions in danger of missing the playoffs? Realistically, yes, San Francisco, though tied with the Seattle Seahawks and Los Angeles Rams at 5 wins, 5 losses, is currently in last place in the NFC West due to tiebreakers. The Arizona Cardinals at 6-4 are only 1 game up in the division, so it's very much wide open. Against the Seahawks, the 49ers' defense was relatively solid, though the unit buckled late when the team needed a stop to preserve the game. Yet since linebacker Dre Greenlaw tore his Achilles tendon during the Super Bowl, and with Talanoa Hufanga sidelined with various injuries, San Francisco's defense has struggled in the red zone and on third downs. The Niners have games left against the Packers, who are 7-3, the Bills, who are 9-2, and the Lions, who are 9-1. They're 1 win, 3 losses in division games. Most concerning for the 49ers is that they have failed to match the play of the better teams in the NFL. San Francisco does not have a single victory against a team whose record is over 500. Also among the losers, the Falcons embarrass themselves and lack consistency or identity. Atlanta revamped its coaching staff, offense, and quarterback outlook, and the goal was to compete for conference championships. The Falcons, as currently constructed, seem very far away from that. A young Broncos team embarrassed Atlanta in a 32-point drubbing in which the Falcons failed to score a touchdown, averaged 2.4 yards per carry, and yet again did not generate a tangible pass rush, allowing rookie quarterback Bo Nix to pop off for 307 yards and 4 touchdowns. The Falcons, who are now 6 wins, 5 losses, still have a solid lead in the NFC South, with the Buccaneers at 4 wins, 6 losses closest. But still, the Falcons are wildly inconsistent, and it's hard seeing them competing with the NFC's best as long as they lack an offensive identity, as well as physicality and speed in their edge rush. And finally, among the losers in the NFL, are the self-destructing Baltimore Ravens truly elite contenders? No elite team self-destructs more than the Ravens, prompting the question, is Baltimore truly an elite contender if it constantly finds ways to lose? The Ravens lost the turnover battle to the Steelers 3-1, with all 3 giveaways field goals. Tucker, the most accurate kicker in league history, missed consecutive field goal attempts in the first quarter from 47 and 50 yards. Tucker has now missed 6 field goals and 1 extra point this season, all of them wide left. His field goal percentage at 72.7% this year is the lowest of his career. Baltimore, who is now 7 wins, 4 losses, was enforced for 12 penalties for 80 yards. Offensive coordinator Todd Monken inexplicably abandons the rushing game. Derrick Henry, who did have a first quarter fumble, carried the ball just 13 times. And now the Steelers, who are 8 wins, 2 losses, have a very nice little cushion in the AFC North division. And again, that feature of Week 11 winners and losers in the NFL is headlined Bengals Season Might Not Be Salvageable, written by Lorenzo Reyes of USA Today. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some college football news. Here's a good headline to read off. Headline reads, Army's game with Notre Dame, the next chapter in a storied history. This feature written by Ken McMillan of the Middletown New York Times. It is unavoidable to work at West Point and overlook the great history of Army football. The championship ring at Michi Stadium recognizes the great Army teams of the past, including the national championship teams of 1944, 1945, and 1946, as well as saluting three Heisman Trophy winners, Glenn Davis, Doc Blanchard, and Pete Dawkins. Jeff Munkin, currently the second winningest coach in Army program history, would not call himself a college football historian, but even he realizes the significance of the famed rivalry between Army and Notre Dame ahead of the 52nd all-time meeting. I see all the history here, he said, and the pictures of the great Army teams of old playing great Notre Dame teams of old. It's pretty iconic, and they played those games in Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds. That's back when I think Army was New York City's team, and Army would play in New York City. I mean, it packed the house, and then when Notre Dame would come into town, I mean, Notre Dame's got fans everywhere. It doesn't matter where they play. They're going to bring a crowd and pack the house, unquote. That's exactly what fans can expect on Saturday at Yankee Stadium in the most significant Army-Notre Dame clash in over half a century. Notre Dame, who is ranked number 6 in the nation and with a record of 9 wins, 1 loss, and unbeaten Army, who is 9-0, is number 18, fighting for a berth in the inaugural 12-team college football playoff. It's pretty neat to be part of a big game like this and the history of it, Munkin said. But the problem is they're really good and really talented, and they're going to be really hard to beat. So we got our hands full, and we'll have to do a great job of preparing, and then we're going to have to play really, really well, unquote. Munkin said that he doesn't want to get caught up in the hype. Quote, our thoughts are try to get better at the things that we can control, and that's blocking and destroying blocks. It's tackling and defeating tackles. It's taking care of the ball on offense and taking it away. It's doing a great job covering kicks, playing with good pad level, he says. That's what I think we've got to do to give ourselves a chance. If I'm telling our guys, this is the biggest game against Notre Dame since 1946, I mean, how does that help our team win? Does it? Munkin posed. It just puts undue pressure on them, unquote. Army hasn't beaten Notre Dame since a 14-2 win at South Bend, Indiana on October 11, 1958, the season that Dawkins won the Heisman. Since then, Notre Dame has rolled off 15 consecutive times. The Fighting Irish beat the Black Knights 27-3 at Yankee Stadium in November of 2010 and prevailed 44-6 at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio on November 12, 2016, the last time the schools met. And again, this feature entitled Army's Game with Notre Dame, Next Chapter in Storied History, written by Ken McMillan of the Middletown, New York Times. And in another feature focusing on this upcoming game against Notre Dame and Army, this one's written by Eddie Tamanus of USA Today Sports. The game takes place on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on NBC. This special contest at Yankee Stadium involving two storied programs with strong national followings has been circled all season. It now has the added bonus of carrying strong playoff implications for both teams as the campaign winds down. The Black Knights of Army have already secured a date with Tulane in the American Athletic Conference title game, and a win here would elevate the importance of that contest by an order of magnitude. The Fighting Irish, of course, have championship aspirations of their own and must avoid a second loss to keep them alive. The Fighting Irish handled their first encounter with an option attack well last month against Navy, so ball security will be priority one for Army quarterback Bryson Daly and running back Kanye Udo as they attempt to control the clock. Army does have outside threats like wide receiver Casey Reynolds and running back Noah Short, but Notre Dame defensive end Riley Mills will look to take away the pitch lanes. Fighting Irish quarterback Riley Leonard and running back Jeremiah Love do a lot of damage on the ground themselves, so Army linebacker Andon Thomas will need a lot of help to keep the holes closed. Notre Dame coach Marcus Freeman heaped praise on an Army offensive line that starts three seniors and averages 307 pounds per man. That has enabled Army to put up 335 rushing yards per game, first in the FBS, while averaging 6.2 yards per attempt, which is third overall. They are led to me by their O-line, Coach Freeman said of Army. They come off the ball. They're physical. They're big. Bigger than what you usually see when you play academy schools. They are aggressive in the special teams. All three phases present some issues that we have to be prepared for, unquote. Also something to watch. In the past month alone, Notre Dame has run three wildly creative fakes on coordinator Marty Biagi's special teams, two on punts and another on an apparent field goal attempt. This is the Super Bowl, Coach Freeman said. This week versus Army at Yankee Stadium is the Super Bowl. If that means that we have to come up with a new fake, then we will come up with a new fake. But I don't ever, ever, ever want to hold something back, unquote. And writer Eddie Tamanus's prediction? Early miscues pretty much ended Navy's bid to topple the Irish before it began. Army will hang around a bit longer, but the Irish will put together enough lengthy marches of their own to offset the Black Knights' game plan. Notre Dame should win this one 23-14. And in other games to watch on the collegiate football level this weekend, headline reads, League title hopes on the line in a hefty slate. This feature also written by Eddie Tamanus of USA Today. Starting with number 5 Indiana at number 2 Ohio State. This game starts at noon on Saturday, noon Eastern Time, on Fox. The day kicks off with this top five showdown that nobody saw coming in August. The Buckeyes' lofty ranking is not a surprise, but the Indiana Hoosiers are enjoying what has already been an historic campaign under first-year coach Kurt Cignetti. The winner here will earn a date with Oregon in the Big Ten Conference Championship finale, though the loser should still be in good stead for playoff consideration. Indiana's high-octane offense, directed by quarterback Curtis Rourke, was slowed a bit by Michigan in its most recent outing, and safety Sonny Styles and the Buckeyes' exceptional secondary could be even harder to solve. The Hoosiers' running back platoon of Justice Ellison and Tyson Lawton must help keep the attack on schedule. Ohio State quarterback Will Howard gets even more ground support from running backs Quinshon Judkins and Travion Henderson, in addition to an ultra-talented receiving core. He can also usually count on excellent protection, but Hoosiers defensive end Mikhail Kamara could change that. Prediction? One can theorize that the Buckeyes enter this fray with all the pressure, while the Hoosiers can let it fly with essentially nothing to lose. That might hold for a while, but eventually Ohio State's next-level talent will take control. Ohio State should win this one 28-17. Another matchup with a ranked team, number 9 Mississippi, will be at Florida. This game also begins at noon Eastern time on Saturday on ABC. With some quality wins, but that pesky 2 in the loss column, Ole Miss finds itself in that precarious space between virtual playoff lock and off the bubble. The Rebels hope to solidify their situation, but this trip to the swamp against a rejuvenated Gators squad might not be a breeze. Ole Miss quarterback Jackson Dart was able to dissect the Georgia defense 2 weeks ago, despite missing several of his top weapons. He hopes that running back Harry Parrish Jr. will be able to rejoin him in the backfield, but he must steer clear of Florida defensive end Tyreek Sapp in any event. Gators quarterback DJ Lagway has also been battling injuries, but provided a needed spark in last week's upset of LSU. Linebacker Chris Paul Jr. and the Rebels' front must be ready for him. Prediction? The Gators will get their 6th win to go bowling, but they'll have to wait a week for their date with hapless Florida State to get it. The Rebels of Mississippi have too much on the line to lose focus in this one. Mississippi should win this one 31-19. And another matchup, number 12, SMU, will be at Virginia. This game also begins Saturday at noon Eastern time on ESPN2. With only a home date with California remaining after this week, the Mustangs of SMU can all but sew up their place in the ACC title game with a win here in Charlottesville. The Cavaliers ran into a buzzsaw last time out at Notre Dame, but have a chance to wrap up bowl eligibility on their home field. The bad news for Virginia is SMU quarterback Kevin Jennings poses a two-way threat similar to what safety Jonas Sanker and company encountered in South Bend, Indiana a week ago. Cavaliers quarterback Anthony Calandrea has been known to put the ball in harm's way when under duress, and safety Ahmad Moses and several of his teammates in the Mustang secondary will be ready to snare any errant deliveries. Prediction: the Mustangs have been bitten by the turnover bug on some of their trips east in their new league. By now, though, they should have that issue under control. So SMU should win this one 33-20 over Virginia. And in a game out west, number 15 BYU will be at number 22 Arizona State. This game is scheduled to begin at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN. Preseason expectations for the Big 12 race have practically been turned upside down. So it is that we find ourselves with this unlikely top 25 clash that is also a de facto semifinal contest for a spot in the conference finale. The Sun Devils' triumvirate of quarterback Sam Leavitt, wide receiver Jordan Tyson, and running back Cam Scatibo can find multiple ways to generate yardage. Cougars linebacker reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Packers Harrison Taggart and Isaiah Klasker will lead the mission to keep them bottled up. BYU quarterback Jake Retzlaff has cooled in recent outings, and ASU defensive end Clayton Smith will do his best to keep him off schedule. Prediction: the Cougars had been living dangerously even before last week's defeat. Quite simply, the Sun Devils are playing better right now, and that will continue. Arizona State should win this one 34-17 over BYU. And in another afternoon matchup, number 4 Penn State will be at Minnesota. This game also begins Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on CBS. The Nittany Lions have only the Ohio State setback marring their record and are still seemingly in the committee's good graces with 2 weeks to go. They would be advised, however, not to stumble against the Golden Gophers, who've had some disappointing results but can be dangerous nevertheless. Since the rough outing against the Buckeyes, Penn State quarterback Drew Aller has taken advantage of less accomplished defenses, with plenty of help from running back Catron Allen and tight end Tyler Warren. They could meet stronger resistance from defensive end Anthony Smith and the Minnesota front. Gophers quarterback Max Brosner has been very good in stretches, though his protectors were overwhelmed in his most recent outing at Rutgers 2 weeks ago. Nittany Lions defensive end Abdul Carter could make his day off difficult again, but Brosmer does have reliable targets in wide receivers Daniel Jackson and Elijah Spencer if he has time to find them. Prediction: Minnesota has won its share of close games this year. This one, however, won't be within reach in the final quarter as the Nittany Lions shut down the Gophers' ground game. Penn State should win this one 27-10. And finally, number 18, Colorado, will be at Kansas on Saturday. This game is also scheduled to start at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Fox. Colorado can play its own way into the Big 12 title game, but this contest is anything but a guarantee. The Jayhawks, fresh off handing BYU its first loss of the season, look to cause even more chaos in their late push to make the bowl lineup. While Buffalo's two-way standout Travis Hunter rightly draws a lot of attention, quarterback Shador Sanders has other weapons at his disposal as well, notably wide receivers LaJonte Wester and Will Shepard. Kansas, however, has the cornerback tandem of Mello Dotson and Kobe Bryant, who can handle most coverage assignments. Jayhawks quarterback Jalen Daniels has played better after a miserable first half of the season. Running back Devin Neal has also been a huge help, but Colorado defensive ends B.J. Green and Keaton Wade will look to keep them in check. Prediction? Both teams know that they can play with anybody in this league. The Jayhawks have figured out how to hang on in one-score finishes, and they will do it again in another huge upset. Kansas should win this one, we think, 34-31. And from football news, let's turn to some basketball news now. Headline reads, San Antonio Spurs are in great shape while head coach is sidelined. And this feature written by Jeff Zilgit, columnist for USA Today. First, get well, Pop. We can't wait to see you back on the sideline doing what you enjoy doing and doing what we enjoy watching you do. Coach the San Antonio Spurs. Greg Popovich had a mild stroke before the San Antonio Spurs game against Minnesota on November the 2nd, the team said in a news release last week. The team said that Popovich has, quote, already started a rehabilitation program and is expected to make a full recovery. At this point, a timeline for his return to be at the sidelines has not been determined, unquote. Take your time, Pop. We want to see you back, but only when doctors say that you can and when you're up for it. The Spurs, the NBA, and the game will be there when you're ready to return. Heck, there will even be a sideline reporter relishing the opportunity to ask you a between-quarter, on-court question. There are probably just a handful of organizations equipped to manage the absence of a Hall of Fame coach, and the Spurs are one of them because of investment in continuity and stability from the franchise starting at the top. The Holt family has held majority ownership of the team for nearly three decades. Spurs sports and entertainment CEO R.C. Buford joined the franchise in 1988, left in 1992, and returned in 1994, and has been there since in a variety of front office jobs. That's 34 years. Buford and Popovich, now in his 29th season as head coach and the NBA's all-time winningest coach, have created a model that other franchises try to emulate. Assistant coach Brett Brown, who first joined the Spurs in 1998 and is now in his second stint and 15th season, has been part of four championship teams. assistant coach Mitch Johnson, who is serving as acting coach in Popovich's absence, is in his ninth season with San Antonio. General manager Brian Wright is also in his ninth season. Dave Telep is in his 12th season with San Antonio, now serving as vice president of basketball operations. And director of collegiate scouting George Felton has been with the Spurs since 2006. It goes on. Head trainer Will Severing was hired in 1998, and team physician David Schmidt has been with the Spurs for 32 seasons. They would have even more long-serving basketball staffers, but the Spurs do such a good job that their employees are hired by other teams. That's not to say that the Spurs won't miss Pop during his absence. They will in multiple ways, including his famous team dinners, but the engine will run with minimal trouble. The Spurs have a plan for the team and for individual players, and the staffers who have been around Popovich for so long will be able to carry out those plans. It won't be the same as hearing it from Popovich, but the players, including second-year star Victor Wembanyama, know the messages originate from Popovich. And it's a solid hunch that Popovich will be watching and probably even sending messages to players and coaches. So get well, Pop. We look forward to your return, but we will do it patiently. And again, that feature is entitled Spurs Are in Great Shape While Head Coach is Sidelined, written by Jeff Zilgit, columnist for USA Today. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.